Good morning. I'm a little emotional. I haven't preached or spoken to a group in person in a really long time. So thank you so much for having me back with you and having me back with you in person. It is medicine that I have needed for a very long time. So I'm going to try to breathe through the emotion that's rising up and talk to you guys today. I come to you in a moment that is heavy with both remembrance and the weight of all that is currently happening in the world. I come to you this morning thinking about how it is we can both care for ourselves in this time and also how we may engage with the second source of Unitarian Universalism, words and deeds of prophetic people, which challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love. How do we also, a gentle, angry, but tired people, join among the ranks of those prophets with our own words and deeds? How do we create the world we dream about while honoring and navigating the one we live in now? So, for those of you who heard me speak the last time I was with you, I mentioned that I used to spend a lot of time in this building. I was a theater major at MTSU and performed in several plays here at the Center for the Arts. I once performed in a production of As You Like It in this building with a 102-degree fever. In another play, I tramped around on stage in a giant Antebellum-era hoop skirt, and I fell down, and it like flipped over my head, and it was a really funny scene for everyone. And then I remember on stage not knowing exactly how to get up one night, but we got through it. I played a maid in a British farce about gambling. I think my character's name was Ida, but the memories on that one are a little bit fuzzy. I also performed in the Laramie Project here, which was a play written about Matthew Shepard and his killing in Laramie, Wyoming, and the aftermath of that hate crime and how it was faced by the community. I taught children's acting classes here too, and I was wandering around the hallways before the service started and spotted a photo of one of the children I used to teach in one of the plays I directed. So again, lots of emotion and nostalgia and thankfulness to be here with you today. All of this happened in the early aughts, from about 2002 to 2005. I was in my early 20s at the time and oh so excited to be gathering in this building or in the theater building on campus night after night to participate in the creation of new worlds through the art of theater. Jumping into a story and playing out the experience of someone outside of myself was an act of deep meaning making and also an intense growth exercise. When I was acting, I was also creating new versions of myself. I was imagining myself in new ways, trying on new ideas, and without question, finding ways to integrate a lot of what I learned about in these theater experiences into my actual life. Now, acting in theater, while one of the greatest loves of my life, is probably my second love when it comes to meaning-making and dreaming up new worlds. For as long as I've been able to listen, I have been a lover of story and have delighted in allegory. As a kid, my father read The Hobbit to my sisters and me. A chapter a night is our bedtime story. And as I grew older, I devoured books like The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and Madeline L'Engle's A Wrinkle in Time. I was one of those kids who thought I was getting away with something when I was reading a book under the covers with a flashlight. But now that I'm a parent, I'm pretty certain my parents were delighted that I was doing this. I really thought I was getting away with it, though. Books were an escape, a refuge, a place to find freedom and for my imagination to run wild. And I often spent non-reading time daydreaming about inserting myself into those plot lines, thrilled at the notion of solving big problems or stepping out of my own world into another. When I dig back into my memory and survey my favorites of these books, a pattern very quickly emerges. I had volume after volume of the Boxcar Children series. I don't know if any of you read these books. The beloved stories of a set of siblings who are orphaned and set up house in a boxcar. At the end of the first book, they begin to live with their grandfather, but somehow in the following books, they always find themselves somewhere new where they have to set up house again and gather all their provisions, making sure they have everything they need as they set out to solve a mystery. I also loved the book from the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler, a story where two siblings run away to live at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Another more obscure favorite was called This Place Has No Atmosphere, and it was about a preteen whose family was one of the first to join a colony on the moon. So at first glance, the theme of all of these books is escape. But I remember very clearly what truly excited me about these stories. I was so intrigued with the notion of forging out on my own, or rather, of landing in a new situation or circumstance and gathering everything I needed to make my way in this new world, figuring out how to adapt and how to set up a new way of life in a new world. I found those challenges exciting, and when I put those books down, I kept up this project in my imagination, a place where I was capable, ingenuitive, and independent. As I started to think about this childhood love of mine, of fantasizing what it would be like to adapt and survive in a new uncharted world, I realized very quickly that, wait, this is actually what I'm doing right now. This is what I've been doing for the last 18 months during this pandemic. It's what I was actually doing even earlier in the aftermath of the 2016 election. Or, wait, what I was doing back in my early 20s, after 9/11, 20 years ago yesterday, when I was a student protesting the dawn of the war in Afghanistan on MTSU campus, or right over there on the square. Over and over again in all of our lives, we have more than once been hit with a startling new reality that has brought up insecurity, confusion, and often fear. Speaking just to the last year and a half, out of what felt like nowhere, we all had to quickly adapt how we lived, shopped, worked, connected with our communities. We all know this. We've been going over it and over it for months. Back in the beginning of all of this, many of us stocked up on provisions, stocked our pantries with toilet paper and other groceries that we thought we would need during this new, dangerous environment. We developed new routines. People who used to only communicate via text message started jumping on video calls. I now am expected to FaceTime my mother once a day, which I never did before the pandemic. Artists began to offer their time and work to produce virtual concerts, virtual church, online dance parties. I went to a couple of those. The adaptation and the imagining we have all witnessed and all partaken in during these new times has indeed been awe-inspiring. And I think, as traumatic and unspeakably stressful that it has all been, those of us who are already versed in meaning-making, in the free and responsible search for truth and meaning, may have been a bit more prepared to dig into this work. So much of our learning around how to move and adapt during these times may have happened when we were younger and developing our imagination, in those stories we read, in the games that we played, in the daydreams that we entertain, all of these wonderful childhood practices, and some who I hope many of us have continued into adulthood, are not just for our pleasure. They teach us how to adapt, how to live, how to create, how to problem solve together. I know that as we gather together at a time when many of us are exhausted, we are just looking for rest and respite, and I honor that. As Unitarian Universalists, many of us are energized by the work of creation and the fight for justice. It's part of our DNA as a movement and built into the principles of our faith. But that doesn't mean that we don't need rest and that we don't long for a break in the bad news. Wouldn't it be blissful if, even for a moment, we could turn on the news or pick up our phones not to learn of some new disaster or some other community that's in desperate need of relief? I do not think it's hyperbolic to say that we are living in a time of great strife and unrest. The news in the world is overwhelming, so overwhelming that it can be hard to continue to pay attention. Climate change, hurricanes from the Gulf to New York, wildfires in the West, earthquakes in Haiti and Mexico, devastating floods here at home in Tennessee. There is also, of course, the pandemic, which won't be quelled due to people whose trust has been destroyed and who have been intentionally led astray at their own peril. We also cannot forget the dire circumstances in Afghanistan and that abortion rights have been stripped away in Texas. It is so hard to know where to turn, what to work on, where to pay attention, where to put in work. There are so many active battlefields in the fight for social justice. And not a single one of us has the capacity the means, let alone the attention span, to do meaningful work in all the places that are needed. So as I've said, it's hard to know where to start, especially when our tanks are already so empty. The first time in my adult life that I felt a true tear in my perception about the world that we live in was on September 11th, 2001, which of course I know many of us are thinking about this weekend. With the 20th anniversary yesterday, my experience of the day and its aftermath as a 21-year-old living far away from home for the first time has been vivid in my mind. I was living and working in downtown Baltimore, Maryland, and on that beautiful blue sky day, I was driving to work in slow city traffic when I flipped on the radio to hear that Tom Brokaw was talking on the pop station. So I was very confused, like immediately. And as I listened, I tried to orient myself to the news. It was the first tower had hit. And so I'm sitting in traffic, and I glance in the cars next to me, and I can just see everyone else's face blank, stunned, sitting in their cars. My disorientation continued when I made my way to work, which was a small mall on Baltimore's Inner Harbor, right next door to Baltimore's World Trade Center. So as I passed that building, I had to ask a police officer who was carrying an automatic weapon if I could duck under police tape to go to work. I got to the small store where I worked and I turned on the radio. I called a few places where I knew my friends would be congregating, one of them being the Red Rose Coffee Shop, where all my friends spent all day, every day, and I had until just a few months before. From the back of the room of the store where I worked, that's where I heard the news about the plane that was supposedly headed to Camp David. And I remember thinking I should hide under the desk in my office. And I called my dad. My dad is an Orthodox Christian priest, and so he decided to say that this was the time to start thinking about eternal life. So I told him I loved him, and I got off the phone. And it was at that time that they actually evacuated my building. I could say a lot more about that day. People were rushing to their cars, looking up at the sky. No one knew what if it was over. No one knew what would happen next. I remember the guilt I felt over the fact that I even had the privilege to lay down and take a nap later. And then when I did, I dreamt of paratroopers falling from the sky. I didn't know what to do with myself. I didn't know how to handle this newly revealed reality. None of us did. But it was this frozen moment in time where suddenly nothing made sense. A week or two later, I attempted to drive from Baltimore up to New Jersey, where my sister and her husband and their one-year-old, who's now 21, and they were all living there. And on the way there, my car broke down, and a friend had to come get me and haul me back to Maryland. That night, it was the night of that massive telethon where all the celebrities came on TV asking for donations and paying tribute. That was on in the background, and I called my parents, and I told them I wanted to come home. I couldn't imagine in that time being in a scenario where I couldn't get to my family easily. Trying to get to my sister that day, having my car break down for me, that was a breaking point. I was learning at that young age that in order for me to stay healthy and whole, I needed to be close to people that I had deep connections with. And this was actually a huge learning for me. I was a young person who had always been sure that I would forge a life for myself far away from Tennessee. I'd lived here my entire life. But I came home, and I started protesting. I started learning about what it meant to take action. I started learning how to speak up and speak out. I don't know how much I moved the needle for anyone else in those days, but it was a deep period of learning for me and for orienting myself with my values. In many ways, it was part of my journey to Unitarian Universalism and to ministry. All these years later, just like in that moment, I still often don't know where to start. In these times where we are laid bare, when we are exhausted, and when our heart is breaking for the world, I think it's an extremely helpful practice, an acknowledgement of our own personal inherent worth and dignity, to give ourselves some grace when we can't fathom what to do next. Lutheran minister and public theologian Nadia Bolz-Weber wrote in her newsletter a few weeks ago, quote, "I just do not think our psyches were developed to hold, feel, and respond to everything coming at them right now. Every tragedy, injustice, sorrow, and natural disaster happening to every human across the entire planet in real time, every minute of every day. The human heart and spirit were developed to be able to hold, feel, and respond to any tragedy, injustice, sorrow, or natural disaster that was happening in our village." not in the entire world, right? When she posted that, I actually saw quotes and screenshots and reshares of this message all across my social media feeds from several of my friends. And with each share of the message I encountered, I imagined the poster breathing a small sigh. Letting themselves off the hook is imperative if we're ever going to propel ourselves back into action. Another block that I often see that keeps me and others I'm in community with from taking some sort of action towards building a new way with one another is that we often don't spend enough time illustrating and reveling in the beauty of the world we're trying to build. Instead, we get mired in the problem itself, in the despair we feel, in the overwhelm that comes with trying to penetrate the systems that hold the problem firmly in place. In her paradigm-shifting book, Emergent Strategy, Adrienne Marie Brown introduced me to a quote by author Tony K. Bambara, so I'm citing within a citation, that says, and I love this, "We must make just and liberated futures irresistible." Something about that quote lit a small fire in me, because I realized that even in my overwhelm, the lifetime practice I've kept of storytelling, imagining, and meaning-making was actually a tool set that I can employ in the work of collective liberation. In order to inspire myself and others to dig in and do the work to right wrongs, to create beloved community, to do our part to meet the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, what could I do to illustrate and bring to life the world we dream about? To quote Adrienne Marie Brown, "Justice, rights, things we take for granted, are not permanent. Once there were kings and queens all over the earth. Someday we may speak of presidents and CEOs in past tense only." Sometimes it just takes someone making a comment like that that's never occurred to you before. I've read this book a couple of times, and I'm going off script right now, but I've read this book a couple of times, and each time I've read that sentence, I'm like, oh, wait. Another world is possible. Someone made this up to begin with. I forget. She also says, "I often feel like I am trapped inside someone else's imagination, and I must engage my own imagination in order to break free." Brown also teaches that one of the most important ways we can work to create change is to allow ourselves to begin to live now as if we are already in the world we hope to create. I have thought about this a lot in the last years, when I've been in the beginnings of ministerial formation, before finally making it to seminary just 2 weeks ago. I am not yet, and am far from, being an ordained minister. But for years after understanding my call, I did not see any path forward to obtaining this vocation officially. And at first I lamented over this. I felt stuck, hopeless, and even resentful. But eventually I realized that it was imperative that I start living my life embodying the future that I had not yet figured out how to attain. And it was that shift in my mindset that got the gears turning. When it comes to activism, to working for social justice, or for standing up to systemic oppression, those of us in the fight have to learn how to practice the future together. Build communities like this fellowship, where we can covenant to the values we wish to see thriving throughout the world. Start here in your own village and stay diligent and watch the ripples spread and water the ground around you. A few weeks ago, after a hiatus that began at the start of the pandemic, a few Broadway shows started reopening in New York. One of them is Hadestown. I'm curious how many people recognize the sermon title today as a reference to Hadestown, the only musical theater. Cool, okay. One of them, I'll tell you about it. One of them, Hadestown, retells the ancient story of Orpheus, Eurydice, Hades, and Persephone. Hades is the king of the underworld. His wife Persephone is the goddess of agriculture and spring growth. Half of the year, Persephone lives up top with the humans, allowing for spring into summer. The other half, she descends into the underworld with Hades, bringing darkness and winter. In the musical, we experience a joyous scene where Persephone returns topside and is celebrated by the people who have been suffering in her absence. Orpheus, the poet in the story, offers a toast to Persephone, praising her for all the life she brings with her, charging the people he is celebrating with to live as siblings and to always raise his glass to the world we dream about and the one we live in now. When the show reopened, I was in Chicago attending my first week of classes at Meadville Lombard, finally stepping into a world that I had dreamed about for so long. I took a walk around the neighborhood where I was staying on another bright, blue, beautiful morning and listened to that song that contained that toast, and it filled my heart right up. In that moment, so much felt possible, in spite of all the pain in the world, because I truly knew, and still know, that we have the power to imagine new worlds, to inspire other people to believe in their possibility, and to get to work building them here and now. So no matter where you are in the process of figuring out how to plug in and do the work, no matter how scared you feel, no matter how tired, no matter how burnt out, whether you have a full basket ready to bring to the feast, or you feel like you come with nothing but the ability to help your neighbor carry theirs, the work you are doing is valuable. Your ability to show up authentically and with an open heart, regardless of what you're bringing with you, is valuable. Your imagination is valuable. Your life and the way you live it has meaning beyond yourself. And as you share what you have with others, and others share with you, you will see love and beauty prevailing in ways large and small. You will see the world changing. May it be so.